This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Democracy North on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, Canadian and Global Independent News and Culture Hour at w2media.ca. On this week's show, we're very excited to present Christian Parenti. He is the author of new book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, and an investigative journalist, contributing editor to The Nation magazine. We'll also be speaking about International Women's Day with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, a renowned author and activist, author of Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, and Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. She's a professor of ethnic studies at California State University. And finally, Kelly Sundberg is a professor of justice studies at Mount Royal University in Calgary. He'll talk about why he thinks that the Canada Border Service Agency needs oversight and to end private guard contracts in the wake of a death of a Mexican woman in custody. All these and more on Democracy North.
Weekday from 7 to 8 a.m. Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda. Thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
I'll be right back with this week's top news headlines. Our top story this week, NATO has announced a full review of its cooperation with Russia to try to pressure Moscow into backing down on its occupation of the Ukraine. But on Thursday, the Ukraine's remaining parliamentarians voted to leave the Ukraine and join Russia. Al Jazeera has this report on the latest in the conflict in Crimea.
Crimea being an autonomous region of Ukraine, the parliament there has voted to join Russia. They're going to hold a referendum to let people have their say on March the 16th. Now, crowds protesting outside the building are largely pro-Russia, but they're not the only ones with views to be heard. Caroline Malone reports.
A woman who joined protest outside Crimea's parliament is dragged away. She's a member of the female exhibitionist protest movement Femin and was trying to express an anti-Russian view. The majority of people protesting here are holding up Russian flags. Their posters and slogans are against what they see as involvement by the British, US and EU in what's happening in the Ukrainian capital Kiev. They say they support a vote by members of parliament in Crimea to join Russia.
We decided to set a referendum for the whole of Crimea, including Sevastopol, for 16 March 2014. The following alternative questions will be put on the referendum. First, do you vote for the reunion of Crimea with the Russian Federation as a subject of the Russian Federation? Second, do you vote for the restoration of the 1992 Constitution and for Crimea to be part of Ukraine?
And that was Al Jazeera reporting. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the Ukraine, about a dozen pro-Russian demonstrators were reportedly injured when an estimated 1,000 protesters took back the regional government building in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk. Some demonstrators could be seen with bloodied faces. Meanwhile, the American anchor for the Kremlin-funded news channel Russia Today has quit on air and accused the network of whitewashing Moscow's military intervention in Crimea. Liz Wall, a Washington-based correspondent for RT America, part of the network formerly known as Russia Today, told viewers yesterday she was resigning because of its coverage of President Vladimir Putin's actions in the Ukrainian region. RT denounced Wall's actions as a self-promotional stunt, and RT has been reporting that the troops in Crimea are not, in fact, Russian soldiers, but local self-defense forces concerned about the recent government overthrow. In Aboriginal Affairs news, facing rising legal costs and cuts to its budget, a booming Indigenous population and a deteriorating relationship with First Nations, the Federal Aboriginal Affairs Department says it faces a high risk of deteriorated relationship, increased protests, and even violence, according to internal department documents. As APTN reports, the Federal Department of Aboriginal Affairs says it faces a high risk it may not be able to even manage expectations around consultation. The documents were obtained under access information by Sherry Pasternak, a student at Columbia University in New York, provided to APTN News. Called the Corporate Risk Profiles, the documents from 2011 to 2013 reveal a bleak picture of Aboriginal Affairs and depict a department on the brink of crisis, struggling to make ends meet as the result of government-wide cuts while facing increasing demands on its dwindling resources. It also shows that First Nations, despite limited financial resources, are drawing blood in their repeated legal rights-based assaults on Ottawa. The documents also reveal that the current government's policy direction is alienating many First Nations and leading to increased tensions. In Border Services news, the death of Lucia Vega Jimenez in Canada Border Service Agency custody is sparking more allegations of mistreatment and highlighting the need for oversight over the federal agency. As Metro Vancouver reports, BCCLA, BC Civil Liberties Association Executive Director Josh Patterson, wrote to the Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney yesterday calling for an independent complaint and review agency to handle complaints against the CBSA. Since news of Jimenez's death in December broke, Patterson says only once many fearful refugees who feel their rights have been violated by the border agency have been contacting the BCCLA and refugee lawyers to air their own grievances against the force. The only recourse, however, against the CBSA is to lodge a complaint against the agency itself. Jimenez died on December 28th, 8 days after attempting suicide while under CBSA custody in a holding cell at the Vancouver airport. It took another month for the public to learn about the death through media reports. We'll be hearing more from an ex-CBSA officer at the end of our program today. In U.S. news, Central Intelligence Agency is investigating allegations it improperly monitored members of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. According to BBC News, a CIA internal watchdog has been tasked with determining if the agency accessed computers of Senate staff. The Senate committee was tasked with investigating a potential past CIA abuse at the time of the alleged breach. But according to BBC, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee called the reports, if true, an extremely serious matter. The alleged improper monitoring is said to have taken place as the committee investigated allegations of CIA abuse stemming from a detention and interrogation program in use under former U.S. President George W. Bush. The New York Times initially reported the allegations of CIA monitoring of Senate computer networks, citing an anonymous official. Down to Ecuador, where a $19 billion judgment against oil giant Chevron in favor of Ecuador drew condemnation of human rights and environmental activists after the company refused to pay anything in fines or accept blame for polluting the Ecuadorian rainforest and indigenous territories. But now, as New York Times reports, a judgment in the United States has overturned that, accusing the lawyer for the peasants involved in the environmental lawsuit of corruption, making it increasingly likely that the oil company would be ultimately successful in beating back the decades-long legal and financial challenge. In his nearly 500-page ruling, the judge did not dispute that pollution occurred in the Ecuadorian Amazon, but he supported Chevron's complaint that lawyer for the Ecuadorian complainants and his team engaged in conspiracy and criminal conduct. Meanwhile, Democracy Now! Reports that plaintiffs say they plan to appeal and still pursue the $19 billion in other countries. In a statement, the group Amazon Watch called the verdict an example of Chevron buying and bullying its way to a verdict, with 60 law firms and thousands of legal professionals hell-bent on exhausting the Ecuadorians and their allies. Over to Egypt, where the trial of three Al Jazeera journalists in the country has been adjourned until March 24th, and the defendants remain in jail on charges of spreading false news and belonging to a terrorist group. According to the Global News Network, British citizen Peter Grest, Canadian citizen Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Bahar Mohamed have been held for more than 2 months. They appeared in court for the second time on Wednesday. The three have been detained since they were taken from their hotel in Cairo on December 29th. Abdullah Shahmi from Al Jazeera's Arabic channel has also been detained, him for more than 6 months without charge, and has been on hunger strike since January 23rd. Journalists at 40 locations across the globe staged vigils in solidarity with a jailed Al Jazeera staff on February 27th in a global day of action, highlighting the need for press freedom. Freedom of speech in Egypt has been the focus of mounting global concern since the government adopted a hardline approach towards journalists. The country has been ranked the third deadliest destination for journalists in 2013 by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Well, that is our news for this week on Democracy North. We'll be right back with an interview in time for International Women's Day with renowned author Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, author of Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. She is a retired professor emerita of ethnic studies at California State University in Hayward. You're listening to Democracy North, a weekly independent roundup podcast of Canadian and global interviews and headlines. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. You can find us at w2media.ca, and we're broadcasting live now on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. Well, for our first interview this week, in time for International Women's Day on March 8th, we interviewed Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on our program. She's author of Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, and the latest book, Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. She is retired professor emerita of ethnic studies at California State University, Hayward, and was interviewed in our program by Jane Bowie. Here is that interview.
So you're going to be in town for International Women's Day events here in Vancouver this week. And I first wanted to start off by talking to you a little bit about International Women's Day. It seems up here in Canada anyway that there's attempts to turn International Women's Day into just another Hallmark card type of event with fashion shows and events for women corporate leaders. Do you believe that International Women's Day is still significant to working class women?
Well, unfortunately, I think you're right. There's a lot of slippage from, not only the far past when women started International Women's Day, working class women did, real, you know, workers, to the 60s, late 60s, when we, those of us involved in the women's liberation movement at that time, rediscovered International Women's Day. Before that, Mother's Day was, mm-hmm. you know, the only day that came close to what we had. And actually, the first conference, my group, the little group we organized in Boston, the first event, big conference we had early 1969, well, in the spring, was on Mother's Day, because we had not yet really, it really hadn't clicked, you know, that International Women's Day was ours and something we could really identify with. So soon after that, we got very busy, and it's, you know, as it's become accepted as International Women's Day, and as the whole month, at least in the United States, has been proclaimed Women's History Month. Mm-hmm. Does that exist in Canada, the Women's History Month?
I think there's some, in a small way, I would say that there's, on campuses, for instance, I think there's a more of a likelihood of it being recognized as such. But I would say that here it's pretty much confined to, at the most, a week.
Yeah. Well, you know, here in the United States, we have these months for everything. September is Latino Month, and February is African American History Month, and November is Indigenous Peoples History Month. So it's kind of, you know, it's okay. We fought for such things, and they do get kind of corporatized very easily here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, now I feel that the whole corporate thing of, you know, the glass ceiling, and there was always a strand of this, you know, from the National Organization for Women Betty Friedan. They were really thinking also of working women, but they really thought of working women like themselves as like wanting to climb the corporate ladder, mm-hmm. to be executives and all. So it was kind of, you know, kind of a, we have, you know.
Fighting against the glass ceiling and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we have two meanings to working women. One is corporate. And the other is prostitution.
Yeah.
And where does that leave, you know, the mass of women?
Yeah.
So actually, we have those two things, the corporate production and the right of sex workers, and very little in between of real, you know, women workers throughout industry and corporations of day-to-day, mm-hmm. hourly paid workers. And for that matter, really poor, you know, home care workers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of organization by our unions going on with home care workers now and domestic workers, but that hasn't been sort of, you know, also included in International Women's Day or that kind of thinking. So, yeah, I agree. It has kind of got hijacked. We need to take it back.
You know, the forums that you're going to be speaking at refer to anti-imperialist revolutionary struggle. And I know that for many of our listeners, that kind of language sometimes seems like a foreign language. So I wondered if we could sort of break it down and if you could talk a little bit about what your how you define imperialism.
Well, imperialism is, you know, at the domestic level or national levels, we have working people, but then we have, at least in the United States and Canada, with, you know, with indigenous peoples, we have this overlay of imperialism and colonialism. So the whole rest of the world, you know, the impoverished, colonized, or formerly colonized world, are the working people of the world. And, of course, I include people who don't have jobs or aren't on the, a regular pay, but are in the informal economy and, you know, just scratching out a living.
How mm-hmm.
And so all of these people, we should, you know, be in those, that's where we should be in the world with women's liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, been able, especially Charlotte Bunch, who is, you know, veteran of the women's liberation movement here, she's done amazing work at the United Nations. I've done some, but my work at the UN has mostly been on indigenous peoples. But I've intersect with that. And at that level, it's really pretty good. But at least in the United States, that doesn't spill out very much into, you know, our cultural thinking about things. There still is an emphasis on, you know, on imperialism and colonialism and, you know, the various terms for it, north and south, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't, at least in the United States, that doesn't really, you know, get out just because nothing does that happens positively internationally organizing. But imperialism, you know, from the very beginning, at least a segment of us in the 60s who started the women's liberation movement called it that, we had been anti-imperialist. We had, you know, already for several years, in my case for several years, four or five years, been deeply involved in anti-apartheid and solidarity with African liberation, of course, with Vietnamese fighting the United States. And we were inspired by the Vietnamese women. We were inspired by Cuban women who had fought in the revolution and throughout Latin America and Africa and Asia. So that was really our inspiration. And we could, and then and now, those of us who had that kind of thinking, which I think is you know, in line with what International Women's Day is about, we cannot separate those two. It's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's built into our DNA.
Yeah.
And we have so little voice. You know, that kind of thinking has been so suppressed in the celebration of the defeat of, you know, the great triumph of capitalism in the West in the early 90s, stamping out revolutions. So we have these little seemingly like brush fires, the Zapatistas and all. Now, the Zapatistas, you know, they have, here's a little corner where they have reawakened.
This was in Nicaragua, the Zapatistas?
This is in Mexico, in Chiapas.
Oh, yeah.
And they're named after Emilio Zapata,
yeah.
The leader of the Mexican Revolution. But they're indigenous peoples, and they have fundamentally, at their very basis, is a women's liberation and the promotion of women's leadership, you know, among them. And they're, you know, completely working class and mm-hmm. peasant indigenous peoples. So knowing that, I know that. I know there are these pockets elsewhere because that doesn't just happen in one place. But to link those things up and to, you know, really build a front, an anti-imperialist women's liberation front, is going to take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was talking to a woman who was involved in the movement in Vietnam and was very disappointed in how, as you said, the women were so involved in working to overthrow the American colonialist regime there and before that the French colonialist regime, and then once they won and were and the people came to power, that the women didn't seem to have the same level of position in that government as she had assumed they would have given the role that they had played. And, you know, I hear about that in other places as well. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's true. That was certainly true in, you know, in Cuba, in Nicaragua. In these, Algeria was at the time in the 60s. Algeria was kind of our template of women having fought in the revolution. All of us admiring the women, being inspired by them, and then, you know, with the independence, became completely male-dominated society. Although not, you know, pretty secular, at least, you know, women and women in all those cases, including the former Soviet Union, women seem to have totally equal access to education, mm-hmm. teaching, nursing. They dominate as doctors and things that we consider very prestigious in the West, but not in government.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is... you know, this is primarily because everyone is in the world, you know, with globalization, and globalization started in 1492, you know, not 1992, that we are all in the world, whether we're conscious of it or not, and the world is dominated by an extremely strong patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think back to when the British were first, you know, started colonizing in the Atlantic, North Atlantic, that especially among the Hodnandusi, that the women were very prominent, and they were also the diplomats. And so in negotiations, women would go to negotiate with the, on behalf of the people, go to negotiate with the British negotiators. And the British would write, it's in their documents, well, we just left because they're insulting us. They sent our women. So, mm-hmm. you know, the people then started, the indigenous people started saying, well, the women said, you guys have to go because they won't even talk to us. We're going to, you know, be able to deal with
mm-hmm.
So, you know, that transformation, that imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism then puts a new template on top of everything. And that's, you know, that's why we can't That's why we can't separate imperialism, capitalism from women's liberation.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to happen automatically, no matter how valiant and all. It's we are in the world. No one is, you know, there's a little pocket of the Zapatistas, you know, autonomous. But that's not how the whole world is going to change. So I think we have to really clarify that and understand, you know, and build strategies that address that reality. We're just going to keep spinning our wheels forever, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You've put that so well. We should actually be winding up, but I'm going to take advantage of having you on the line and just explore one more issue, and that's you have an upcoming book, Home of the Brave, an Indigenous History of the United States, and wanted to explore the concept of it. Do you think the struggle for Indigenous rights is part of that anti-imperialist struggle?
Oh, absolutely, because this is, you know, like the initial, of course, I'm a historian, and, you know, I think in these millennium rather than years, but, you know, history isn't past. The whole hemisphere of indigenous peoples in the Americas were societies where women had, I mean, they differed, they weren't all the same, but women had equality and absolutely had power, you know, in many cases, disbalanced power, like the Dene people, you know, that believed that women needed to be dominant because men didn't behave properly without that dominance, and there's still a lot of that, you know, but this indigenous cultures in the Americas they're still there, the vestiges. So it's such an important strength to be built upon, you know.
And that was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, author of Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War and Red Dirt Growing Up Okie. She is a retired professor emerita of ethnic studies at California State University and was interviewed by Jane Bowie in our program. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek. You can also find us on the Rabble Podcast Network, on iTunes, and on CHLY Radio in Nanaimo. Well, our next interview is with Kelly Sundberg. He's an Associated Professor of Justice Studies at Mount Royal University in Calgary and was 14 years an immigration officer in Canada. He spoke about the death of Mexican woman Lucia Vega Jimenez in custody of the CBSA in last December, which has sparked a public inquest soon to be launched in September, and calls from civil liberties and migrant justice organizations for an inquiry and oversight and accountability for a federal agency that currently is only accountable to itself. I spoke to Kelly on our program last Thursday about why he is particularly concerned about private security guarding by Genesis Security Group that is contracted by CBSA. Here's our interview.
Could you start off by talking about your history in terms of immigration and your previous work?
Well, prior to being an associate professor, I was an enforcement officer for the Canada Border Services Inland and Immigration Enforcement Division for about 14 years. I worked in various capacities. I was a hearings officer for a year, senior policy officer in Ottawa for a bit, and then prior to the CBSA, I worked for CIC as an immigration officer. So quite a bit of experience with the enforcement side of immigration. And then my PhD that I did at Monash University in Australia focused on issues of immigration enforcement comparing Australia to Canada. So that's kind of my background.
Well, that's actually very interesting as well. Maybe we can talk about that a bit later. Now, the BC Coroner announced it's going to be holding a public inquest into the death of Lucia Vega Jimenez in their custody, CBSA's custody, in December. I wonder, what are your thoughts on the inquest being called and in this case overall?
Well, I think it's the right thing to do. But it just highlights, again, the need for the CBSA to have an external arm's length oversight body. And get the CBSA is a relatively new agency. It's only a little over 10 years old. And that the legacy organizations that comprise today's CBSA, that being Customs, Food Inspection, and Immigration, really weren't policing agencies as such, although they did have enforcement capacities. I mean, the reality is that the CBSA has evolved into a policing agency. It's for all intents and purposes Canada's border police. And like any police agency in Canada, there needs to be some degree of impartial oversight. And this tragic death just stands to show that we need to have an oversight body for the CBSA. That's not to say that the CBSA isn't doing really good work. I do think that, you know, their most recent performance review showed that the agency is actually doing quite a good job in identifying contraband and identifying people that pose a threat to Canadian society and this sort of thing. But whenever you have an agency that has sweeping policing powers, there really needs to be in place a check to that power so that we can ensure the legitimacy and the credibility of the agency within the eyes of Canadians. And I think that's one important part that's lacking in the CBSA.
Do you think that it's a good thing that it's become so much of a policing-focused organization with many officers carrying firearms? For instance, I know that's been controversial with conducting kind of, raids on construction sites. It's kind of more what you'd more associate with the American ICE program.
Well, you know, the agency, the CBSA, the officers, like when I worked for, when I was an investigator with Citizenship and Immigration Canada prior to the CBSA, and then when I turned over into being an enforcement officer for the Immigration Division of the CBSA, my job didn't really change. The CBSA officers or Inland Immigration Enforcement officers have always conducted enforcement activities within Canada, going to businesses, seeking out people who are in violation or believed to be in violation of the immigration law. So, I mean, a lot of the functions actually haven't changed since the CIC days. What has changed is the carrying of firearms, but I don't have an issue with it. I think that it's an inevitability that happened. The CBSA, in today's atmosphere, especially having neighbors to the south such as the United States, I think it was an inevitability that we would go down this way. In the era of global terrorism and having the Americans very concerned about how we control and enforce border laws, really, I can't see it having gone any other way. In saying that, so I'm not particularly at issue with the. I actually support the creation of the CBSA and giving it a law enforcement mandate. But what I do have concern about is that it seems to have been done a little bit on the cheap. And I say that in that the training, the selection of officers, the ongoing in-service training really is lacking when compared to other agencies such as the RCMP or Toronto Police, Vancouver, Calgary, like the big policing departments in the country, OPP. So in that regard, I think it was a good move. It's just I think they could have gone about it better.
And one thing that has changed is subcontracting. And when I've been examining a fair bit around Genesis Security Group. It's a large company here in Vancouver that does a mix of VIP guarding and event security. But they are actually contracted to run the detention facility at the airport that CBSA runs and potentially even the one in the library downtown that's not been confirmed yet. But what are your thoughts on this contracting out? Are there risks involved in that? I mean, it's understood that the guards were on duty when Lucia was found hanging in the shower stall.
Yeah, I have a real concern, not just with the CBSA contracting out guarding type duties to private contractors. Also, we see this seems to be a trend in other agencies, such as the CATSA, the screening officers at the airports. Those are contracted employees too. You know, if the government, for the Harper government, which has this get tough on crime and this security focused agenda, to really have the window dressing of security and professionalism in security and law enforcement to behind the scenes contract things out where we contract, certain aspects of CBSA duties, also TATSA, really is concerning. You get what you pay for, and you know what? There's some areas where savings by outsourcing doesn't make sense to me, and security is definitely one of them.
Well, you usually hear with government outsourcing, it's, you know, cleaning staff or linens or food, the kind of background stuff. This is frontline jail cell guarding and escorting detainees and deportees. What are your biggest concerns around having a private company do that?
Well, one, accountability. Two, the level of training, the screening of those individuals. The accountability or the level of communication between the private company to the government. I have a lot of concern over it. I think that some jobs, like you said, like cleaning and linens and food services, all right. You know what? If it saves taxpayers money, I'm all for it. But when it comes down to security-focused jobs where you have a private contractor who is at times responsible for the safety and security of those in detention and ultimately for the safety and security of the Canadian public, I have a real problem with that.
Would you like to see the agency end its subcontracting to Genesis and to other companies like it?
Yes. How's that for a definitive answer? Definitely. I think it's, you know what? I think that they can have officers, either they have to have an incredibly robust policy and training program for these individuals, which would probably negate the savings they'd have in subcontracting it out, or... You know what? If the government is serious about security, serious about public safety, then have federal sworn peace officers who are federal government employees do those jobs.
Any last thoughts, Dr. Sundberg, about what you, if this tragic case might potentially lead to some important changes in CBSA, what those might look like to you, and if you do think this might lead to any changes?
I really hope it does bring about the formation of some oversight body that is arm's length from the CBSA itself. If anything comes out, I really hope that that's one of them. And I also hope that it also sparks, like you said, the issue of private contractors. I hope it causes the federal government to take great pause and seriously consider if that's what Canadians want. There's a lot of examples. I had this in my dissertation also with issues of private security in Australia, and a lot of the similar type concerns that we're seeing right now with the CBSA and the issues around private contractors, they've existed a long time in Australia, and they've done a lot of research from an Australian perspective on the concerns around private security and being responsible for immigration detention centers and the transporting of individuals. And, why Canada doesn't learn from the Australian mistakes boggles my mind, especially when there's such a robust body of literature coming out of Australia showing that private security is not the best approach.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yes, you're one of the, this is the other thing too, is you're one of the few reporters that's really got on this. Like, it boggles my, it really concerns me that this hasn't become a bigger news story. Good on you, because you're doing a hell of a job.
No, thanks so much, Kelly. Take care, eh?
Okay, take care.
And that.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Dr. Kelly Sundberg. He is a professor of justice studies at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Before that, he was 14 years an immigration officer, and he's the co-founder of the International Institute for Criminal Justice Research. You can find out more about him at our website, w2media.ca. We'll be back with Christian Parenti, renowned author, talking about his book on climate change. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, as well as at w2media.ca/thisweek, Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. We're for a final interview this week. We have renowned author Christian Parenti. He's editor at The Nation magazine in the States, an investigative journalist, and his latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Derek O'Keefe interviewed him on our program last Friday before his speech and tour in Canada. Here's Christian Parenti.
Christian, your book, Tropic of Chaos, touches or hints at this debate around the state, but you have a piece in The Nation from a year or two ago that really puts it in the headlines, why climate change will make you love big government.
Right.
Tell us why the climate crisis really forces us all to reconsider the role of the state in our society and intervening in the economy.
Well, the climate crisis is on a scale that I think forces the state back to the center of politics, and it also reveals the centrality of the capitalist state to the actual functioning of capitalist economies, which is a key point that, in this sort of next book that I'm working on. It's a key point that the left sometimes overlooks, to, I think, its own detriment, and that is because the right, the sort of the neoliberal hegemony of the last generation, has pilloried the state and attacked it and sort of successfully marginalized it as an object of serious political inquiry. So we criticize the state, we criticize its wars and its, you know, prisons, and I've, you know, made a career doing that, but we sometimes, I think, don't think about how central it is to the everyday operation of capitalism, how, in fact, capitalism can't exist without the state. The state pre-existed capitalism, and it will exist after capitalism, and capitalism is totally dependent on the state in many ways. And then, in terms of climate change, the extreme weather that comes with climate change creates crises, environmental, social, and economic crises that force the state to take a bigger role in everyday life. So you see this at the urban level around storms that have been happening in Atlanta. The first time the snow and ice came this year, they were caught unprepared. And the second time, the state made a big show of being prepared and attending to the infrastructure. So it's very simple, but the discourse in the United States, you know, less so here in Canada, is so virulently anti-statist that these basic facts have to sort of be pointed out to us by the weather. That actually, you know what? If you treat sanitation workers like garbage and you try and smash their unions and get rid of them, well, eventually the city that capital depends on won't function when the fill-in-the-blank ice, snow, drought, flood, whatever it is, comes. So the extreme weather climate change shows that the state has to respond, because either it doesn't respond, and that's a spectacular catastrophe socially for people, but also for business sometimes. Okay, yes, then they use it, as in New Orleans, you know, the disaster of the Katrina storm. It was then used by capital to evict poor black people from the city and redevelop it, New Orleans, in a fashion that capital had wanted for decades. But there's also examples like the Hurricane Irene, which wasn't even a hurricane when it hit New York, and how well the Bloomberg administration acted to protect the subway, and all these kinds of things that just make it increasingly difficult to deny the centrality of the state. And so I think we have to have a strategy that starts thinking about what the state is, thinking about its contradictions, thinking about the progressive aspects of government. That part of how capital depends on the state is because it has to submit to some extent to the rationalizing forces of planning. And it hates that. Individual capitalists in particular, politicized right-wing capitalists, hate that. But the reality of the system is that it cannot function without that. And that's an opening for the left to start pushing an agenda at a scale that I think is commensurate with the problem of climate change.
Does this mean we have to be sort of cautious of glorifying DIY responses to the climate crisis? On the one hand, you had, when Sandy hit New York, you had the remnants, I guess, of Occupy Wall Street organized as Occupy Sandy. Now, this was very inspiring because it was bottom-up, very grassroots. But is there a danger that in doing it ourselves, we forget to put demands on the state to provide these basic emergency services and non-emergency?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Completely. And it's not to belittle the efforts of people involved in Occupy Sandy and similar grassroots DIY efforts, response to Katrina down in New Orleans. That's all really, really important and really valiant, and people have made real sacrifices to do that. But it is, in and of itself, isn't enough, and we have to be honest about that. The amount of houses rebuilt by the efforts of the left in New Orleans were minuscule compared to the amount of money that was available, even under the twisted circumstances for low-income housing rebuilding from the state. So the state is a whole bunch of assets that generations of progressives and leftists fought to get a piece of. And so we should defend things like public schools, public housing, the post office, and public education, all of which are under attack in the United States. The public sector is coming under incredible attack. I mean, they're privatizing school systems. I mean, half of the schools in Philadelphia, New Orleans, and Chicago are essentially privatized under charters. So I think it's about not romanticizing DIY, but more to the point, it's about how do we articulate the relationship between this grassroots DIY solidarity and demands on the state. And at what scale, what level of the state can those movements fit in a way that's helpful? Because, of course, the danger, I'm not going to deny the danger of the state, not just its repressive, you know, dangers, which I've written about, but also it's like kind of co-opting and absorbing capacities that, you know, protests can be blunted not just through repression, but also through being absorbed into the state apparatus and, you know, turned into administrators. So there's lots of dangers in engaging with the state, but I think understanding, mapping, articulating what the state is, and then what it could be and should be, and making demands around that is really important. And right now, we really don't have much of a discourse about this. It's just like state bad, people good. And that's actually kind of actually a really neoliberal template.
Well, the right wing that wants to eliminate the EPA or eliminate any kind of regulation or oversight of big industrial projects, they want to smash the state in their own way. Right. So there's, I think the certain aspects of your argument will be fairly intuitive or easy to understand, like defend the MPA or the EPA, pardon me, strengthen the EPA. But there's other levers or tools the state has that you've mentioned before. You talked about the issue of procurement and how significant that could be to fighting climate change, reducing emissions. Could you give some examples of that? Because it's not something I hear many people talk about.
Yeah. Well, in the United States, the public sector is about 38% of the economy. And this is a point that only the right wing makes, and the left doesn't make much of it. But so you think, wait a minute, that's actually a lot of resources that we could use to help push the economy away from fossil fuels.
What are the implications of your argument for the centrality or importance on the UN talks that continue every year, but sort of since Copenhagen in 2009 and to some extent Cancun in 2010, when you had at least you had Bolivia sort of on its own waving its hand saying that this was totally ineffectual what the countries were agreeing on. I think since then, a lot of activists have said, look, it's not going to get solved at the UN talks. Let's go grassroots and block individual projects. Mm-hmm. The argument you're making about the state seems to also have an element there about these UN talks, that it's still very significant what the states themselves agree to.
I think more important is actually the national level, because I don't think these international agreements, it's just they're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And like the change we are seeing is happening at the national level due to national level politics. So you have like places like Spain, Portugal, and Germany have built out their renewable energy sectors like very significantly. Right. You know, Spain at any given time last year, wind was the single biggest source of electricity in the Spanish grid. And Germany, very famously, because of its feed-in tariff, at times has majority clean energy in its grid, to the point where it's causing real problems for its coal-fired utilities and stuff like that. China, similarly, though it's still building lots of fossil fuel-fired power plants, is building out wind and solar capacity. And that has to do not really with international agreements, though the Clean Development Mechanism did actually help China fund a lot of that stuff. So I'm a bit of a square on that. Like, I don't really see the problem for each country's, you know, giving even China money to develop clean energy. But
it seems preferable to exporting all of our coal from here to China and gas as well.
Yeah.
I mean, so, it's a big issue. Or the tar sands themselves.
Yeah. So I actually think that... I'm actually pretty critical of that. I mean, I don't have much hope for these international agreements. Mm-hmm. And I do think what is important is the economic knock-on effects, the economies of scale that are created when big economies make national-level decisions to change their investment. And then that's what... In other words, if the U.S. decides it's going to get off of coal and natural gas and onto solar and wind, that's going to have global impacts. To the extent that China is doing that, is already having a significant impact.
And that was Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. That's our show for this week. Thanks for listening to Democracy North. You can find us at w2media.ca/thisweek.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda. Thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcast at w2media.ca.